This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with the show's producer, Kerry Jr. II.
How you doing, Stephen?
Today is another one of our look back days at things that we did on Detroit Today, the show I used to host, that fit with Created Equal. Created Equal, of course, was a podcast we used to do on Detroit Today, where we talked about opportunity and inequality. And today, we'll look back at a series of conversations we had with writers from The Atlantic, and they were about the work that they did in a series called Inheritance, which was trying to look back at some moments and things from Black history, tell more about them than had been told, and fill in blanks, right? Some of these things, some of these stories didn't get a lot of attention, or some of these people didn't get a lot of attention. They had some really great writers, which they do at The Atlantic,
right,
take part in the series. And each one of them, before the articles debuted, came on to Detroit Today to talk about the work.
We're going to rehash a series. We're going to visit your series about their series.
About
the history of some Black folks.
Right. So it's a little like a mirror of a mirror of a mirror.
Right. Yeah. What kind of topics did they touch on? What were they really looking at the history of?
You know, they were really looking at things that African Americans had achieved or had done that were discounted or just forgotten. You'll hear from Clint Smith, who was the author of a book, How the Word Was Passed. We had a conversation with him as well. Here he's writing about Black writers who had not gotten their due. Adam Harris, who writes about a riot started in Alabama that was intended to suppress the Black vote. And then you'll hear from Jillian White, who was the managing editor of The Atlantic and the person who put this whole series together. So let's start with just a brief explainer of what the Inheritance Project is and talk about the name. I'm always curious about how we come up with the way that we describe this kind of journalism.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Inheritance Project, you know, the introduction you gave is exactly right. The goal of the project is to fill in the pages of American history, of history in general, with the story of Black people. You know, as the magazine of the American idea at The Atlantic, we look at American history a lot. We think about American history a lot. And Black people, though we know them to have been foundational in building this country literally, but also figuratively creating the engine that allowed for our economy, adding to culture, et cetera, they are curiously missing from the creation myth of America. So this is trying to do what should have been done a long time ago, which is infuse Black people, their lives, their contributions, and what they endured back into that narrative and creating a more complex narrative. Mm. And Inheritance really came from the idea of thinking about what we were trying to do here and thinking about the world that we live in. So we were thinking a lot about the world and the stories and the narratives that we have inherited from our ancestors, and what our children and what the next generation will inherit from us, and thinking about the fact that the truth, complex and ugly as it may be sometimes, is the best thing that they can inherit, a world where they truly understand what their place is and that things are diverse and complicated and also beautiful, and that by knowing all of that history and by having the full scope of what this country is and how it came to be, only then can they really create a better future for themselves and then their children.
The idea of these stories being hidden. I mean, one of the things that I think is really important to note is that it doesn't have to be sort of an intentional hiding. That too often we restrict discussion of racism and inequality to the idea of people doing things quite purposely. And in some cases, there's no question that that's the case. But one of the things that I think is really interesting about this work is it really reflects the way that institutionally African-American experiences, African-American stories, the first person sort of ownership of those stories and narratives is subjugated in our country, that despite the presence of strong African-American storytellers, despite efforts to make sure that African-American history is included in the telling of American history, there are these very powerful, consistent institutional forces that just keep these stories submerged and keep them away from, I guess, the master narrative of our country.
Yeah, absolutely. And Clint will get into this a lot. I know you're talking to him a bit later. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to think a lot. He has said this so many times. You have to think a lot about who these stories were being told to and then who was kind of filtering those stories through a specific lens and putting them out into the world. You know, the fact of the matter is that for a very, very long time, for pretty much the entire known history of the United States being the United States, you know, everything has been filtered through the lens of white people and largely through the lens of white supremacy. So a lot of this history, a lot of the history of what was done to indigenous peoples, a lot of the history of what was done to black people in America does not paint white people in a really great light. It is complicated and upsetting. And, you know, telling the truth about that, telling the real nuance of those stories. And it's not just about the trauma of those things, right? It's not just about telling the story of slavery. If you were to tell this true full story of black people and of indigenous people, you would have to talk about their brilliance and all of the things they accomplished and how inventive they were and all of those things, how much like wonderful kind of thought and invention came out of those communities and how much of that has been baked into America, how America has been able to progress because of people of color. And I think that is a very scary thing for a group of people who have for a really long time wanted to hold on to power and kind of be the people who are moving the country forward. Mm-hmm. So I think that's another part of it. It's not just wanting to suppress this idea of horrible things that were done by their ancestors. It's also this idea of, you know, having to share the credit for how this country came to be a superpower and how this country came to be such a, you know, in the ways that it is wonderful, a wonderful place. And that is largely due to the work and the thoughts and the efforts and the inventions of people of color. Mm.
It's also, I think, worth noting that it's a big deal for a publication like The Atlantic to take on the sharing of these stories and the confronting of the ignorance about these stories in our history and in our present. And that doesn't happen 10 years ago, I don't think. That certainly doesn't happen 30 or 40 years ago. Frankly, you as managing editor of that publication, as an African-American woman, that doesn't happen 10 yeah. or 30 or 50 years ago. There is something about this moment that makes this more possible, I think, than maybe it has ever been.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, a huge thing we talked about while we were coming up with this project is what responsibility The Atlantic has to do this work. We talk a lot about how one of our founding ideas was to be a magazine dedicated to abolition, which is true. This was a magazine that one of its founding arguments was that people should not be enslaved in America. And we have a responsibility to live up to that and to live up to representing and arguing for and thinking deeply about the place of that same group of people in the country now. But you're exactly right. You know, I've been at The Atlantic for 7 years. And in that time, I've seen the newsroom change so much. My role has changed so much. And I want to be very clear that a project like this, one, is not born out of the brain of one person. And a project like this is not possible without a newsroom that is diverse and where those ideas of people of color, of writers of color, of editors of color are heard and given the space to grow and flourish.
Yeah. Jillian, I also want to talk a little about the potential reaction to this kind of work. We saw the New York Times last year publish their 1619 project, or actually it was 2 years ago, and they got a lot of pushback from people who didn't want to confront our nation's past, who wanted to challenge the facts that were included in the work. What's your expectation for a publication like The Atlantic, which it may surprise some people still to see you take on subject matter this way?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you are a Black journalist and talking at all about the place of Black people in society, you are always prepared for a certain level of, let's call it, negativity that will come your way. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is the responsibility of journalism. This is the responsibility of this publication. This is the responsibility of me as a Black woman at a really, really old publication that focuses on these ideas. So we are incredibly careful in what we put out there. We think deeply. We fact check. We do all of that stuff. So when our reporting goes out, I feel incredibly confident in it. And I feel incredibly confident in the writers and editors working on this project. So if people have a problem with the project because they have a problem with confronting history, then that's exactly the reason that we are doing it. And I will take that heat.
Jillian White, you recently told The Atlantic's editor-in-chief, Jeffrey Goldberg, and you said, for so many Black Americans, history is a dead end. And I think Adrian's experience really reinforces that. We don't see ourselves in the telling of the American story.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's exactly true. You think about the past, as you said, the past decade, 15 years, and how much more you're seeing people of color, Black people on TV in so many different capacities, right? We can now look at TV and we see the Vice President of the United States, right, who is a Black woman. Mm-hmm. But I remember when Barack Obama was campaigning and seeing him out with Michelle Obama and just thinking about trying to wrap my head around the idea of seeing a Black family in the White House and couldn't quite grasp it. And I was, you know, a young adult, but an adult. Mm. And you think about how much that infects your day-to-day life. It infects your thinking and your belief of what is possible. And then I think about my daughter and my niece and my nephew and what they will think of as jobs for them or places they can be or places they belong just from the sheer fact of seeing themselves there, seeing people who look like them there. And it really is incredible.
That was Jillian White from The Atlantic. Coming up next, we're going to talk with another contributor to The Atlantic's Inheritance Project, Clint Smith. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit, and I'm Stephen Henderson. Today, I'm revisiting conversations I had with Atlantic staff writers who contributed to the Inheritance Project. Our next guest recently took a deep dive into uncovering the stories of formerly enslaved Americans documented in a 1930s government initiative that you have likely never heard of. It was called the Federal Writers Project, and it was part of a 1935 job creation effort during the FDR administration. The project contained various photographs and manuscripts that were documenting all kinds of American life. But in his new piece, Atlantic staff writer Clint Smith focuses on one set of stories specifically, the slave narratives, which is composed of more than 2,300 first-person accounts of slavery. Joining us now to talk about what he learned from delving into this really rich collection of interviews and narratives is staff writer at The Atlantic, Clint Smith. Clint, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So you start your piece by describing a visit you took last year to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington. Can you talk about what you saw on the bottom level of that museum in the area devoted to showing the history of slavery?
Yeah, so on the bottom floor of the museum, for anyone who's been to the museum, it's this remarkable, expansive, obviously decades-long in the making project that documents the history of Black life in this country. And the bottom floor is sort of singularly dedicated to tracing the story of enslavement. And so you walk past Thomas Jefferson, a statue of Thomas Jefferson, someone who's typically venerated, and you see behind him a bunch of bricks that represent the hundreds of people he enslaved. You walk past a cabin that actual enslaved people slept in. You walk past a stone block that actual enslaved people were sold from. And down the hallway, there's a room where you hear these voices sort of emanating around you. And those are the voices of people who were interviewed for the Federal Writers Project between 1936 and 1938. And it's this remarkable treasure trove of information because, as was mentioned, it's 2,300 people who've had their stories documented. And so often the stories that we hear around slavery have been Frederick Douglass and mm-hmm. Harriet Jacobs and, Henry Box Brown, and these stories of these remarkable, exceptional people often who, using the Underground Railroad or some other means, escaped slavery and have these incredible, exceptional stories to tell. But part of what I argue is that these pieces in the Federal Writers Project, these stories in the Federal Writers Project, are so important because they tell the stories of ordinary people. They tell the stories of people who weren't quote unquote exceptional. But that lack of exceptionalism doesn't make their stories any less worthwhile engaging with. In fact, I argue that they give us a more clear sense of what the totality of slavery and the landscape of slavery was like, because not everybody was Frederick Douglass and not everybody right. was Harriet Jacobs. And, these were very special people in very particular sets of circumstances. And in order to really understand, I love reading the narrative of Frederick Douglass more than anyone, but we should also understand that that is not representative of the sort of larger landscape of what enslavement did. And so what these stories do is provide us with insight into the sort of daily quotidian nature, both the brutality and the humanity of slavery from those who experienced it firsthand.
So I have spent more time in the last 5 or 6 years digging into my family's past to try to put together, missing pieces of the story about how we got from slavery to where we are now. And the further I go back and as you get closer to identifying relatives, people who came before you who were enslaved, there's a feeling of both excitement and dread that I have experienced over and over again. I mean, literally, like the hair will stand up on the back of my neck sometimes when you find a name or find a document that points to something. And I imagine that if I could hear the voices of those people or even read a transcript of something that they said, I would have those feelings, to an exponentially larger degree than I already have. So I'm really wondering for you, what feeling this evoked when you could hear those voices, when you could sort of just put to these names, a voice or a narrative that reflected their lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly special. In the museum, not every single one of the sort of 2,300 narratives and interviews have recordings alongside of them. Some of them do, but not all of them. So the ones that you hear in the museum are a mix of actors who are reading the words from the transcript of formerly enslaved folks, and some of them are the enslaved folks themselves. And it's just, I mean, it's powerful. Part of what I try to remind people is that the history we tell ourselves was a long time ago, was not in fact that long ago at all.
Right.
My grandfather's grandfather was born into slavery. And so there will be these moments where my 3-year-old son is sitting on my grandfather's lap. And I imagine my grandfather sitting on his grandfather's lap. And I'm reminded that, in the scope of human history, slavery was just like a few seconds ago, and so there's this sort of emotional proximity, I feel. And then to consider that these interviews were done in the late 1930s, with people who, you know, these are folks who were, the majority of the folks who were interviewed were people who were children as enslavement came to an end toward the end of the Civil War. And to just think about how, I mean, there are still thousands, if not millions of people around this country who loved and were raised by and had relationships with people who were born into slavery. Mm-hmm. And it really disabuses us of this notion that slavery is singularly this thing of the past that has no bearing on what the contemporary landscape of inequality looks like. You know, we know that from historian David Blight that the 4 million enslaved Black people in 1860 were worth more than every bank, factory, and railroad combined. Mm-hmm. The greatest catalyst of economic wealth and prosperity that this country has ever known were the bodies of enslaved people. And after the Civil War, these people who created this previously unimaginable wealth for this country were given none of it. And we want to pretend as if that thing is simply something that we watch in a movie, that we watch in 12 Years a Slave, or that we read in Frederick Douglass, and we say, oh, that was horrific. But it actually, you know, that doesn't have anything to do with the country we live in now. We're so different. We had a Black president. We have a Black vice, a Black woman vice president. And it's stories of, in the same way that stories of Frederick Douglass and Harriet Jacobs are at once incredibly important. I'm thinking about that as I think about, you know, the way that Barack Obama or Kamala Harris and their ascent or Oprah, whoever, you know, name a Black person, are used in a way to otherwise delegitimize claims that there is a sort of larger set of oppressive forces that exist. But the truth is that stories of exceptionalism have always, or systems of oppression have always relied on stories of exceptionalism in order to legitimate an otherwise oppressive system. And so, all that's to say, when you read these stories and you realize that these are people who were living in the 30s and in the 40s, and that there, again, there are people alive today who were raised by these people. You know, so that in the piece, I interviewed the three descendants of people who were interviewed in the transcript. Right. And, you know, it was powerful for me to read these. And, you know, I have no direct sort of connection with my own lineage to these transcripts. But I can, you know, I could only imagine, even as I was having these conversations with these men and women, what it meant for them to see these photographs of these people, what it meant for them to hear their voices, what it meant for them to, you know, read their words. It was every single person I interviewed, many people for the piece, and ended up focusing predominantly on three. But every single person I spoke to said it was just so powerful and so moving. And as you said, the hair stood up on their arms.
Yeah. I do want to talk just a little about the federal effort to get these stories and preserve them. I mean, the 1930s is one of my favorite times in history to think about what the federal government was up to. I mean, it's a time, of course, of incredible American economic suffering, universal suffering. But the government's response to that suffering reached a level of creativity I'm not sure it did before or after. And so I want to talk just a little about this Federal Writers Project and what the purpose was of that project in preserving these stories, but then talk about why they weren't disseminated as widely as they should have. Why have most Americans never heard of this?
Yeah, I think there's a couple reasons. So the origins is stories, as you mentioned, these were done following the Great Depression, and it was both done as a means of deep creating an archive of stories and interviews of people who lived through exceptional times in American history. And so formerly enslaved people were one group of folks who were interviewed, but they interviewed people across the country who had experienced a range of different iterations of what America has been. And the economic part of it was that it was meant to be a jobs program, right? Like it was, there were many, many out of work writers and journalists and artists. And part of what they were hoping to do was put those folks back to work. And so they hired these people and they did it in, I believe, 16 or 17 states. And so they went and began collecting these stories, but there were issues with the sort of collection process, in part because, you know, this is also the 1930s in the Jim Crow South. Mm-hmm. And so many of the people who were tasked with collecting these stories carried their own deep biases, their own deep prejudices, their own, you know, pretty clear racism. And that was imbued and that animated the way that they approached the formerly enslaved people, the way that they transcribed the language. And so, you know, a lot of historians who write about the Federal Writers Project will talk about the dialect in which through which the interviews are portrayed. And on the one hand, a lot of these formerly enslaved folks were often illiterate. They often hadn't received, because of the insidiousness of slavery, often hadn't received a lot of formal education, if any. On the other hand, there was also an effort by some of these interviewers to purposefully paint the people they were interviewing as ignorant, as dumb. And so they would write in ways that sort of emphasized and seemed to focus on and magnify a sort of lack of literacy, magnify the sort of colloquial and sometimes even the language that you can't always even read and understand as you try to read it. And so they, you know, in what ways that they consider to be, you know, as historian Catherine Stewart writes, quote, authentically Black, which is loaded with its own set of, you know, racist preconceptions. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of it. Part of it is that the interviews are conducted and transcribed in ways that are often animated by the racism of the people doing the interview and then doing the transcribing. The other part of it is that if you just consider the context of the moment, if you're an elderly, formerly enslaved person living in the South, and you have this white person you have never met coming up to your house and saying, I work for the federal government and I want to talk to you, the power dynamics in place are clear from that moment. And so, you know, there might have been people who thought that these workers were someone who might take away their the check that they got, the sure. federal assistance that they got. So they might have told them stories about what slavery was or wasn't that fit into what they thought that person wanted to hear. Because at that moment, their primary concern is like, don't take away my federal assistance, right? Because these are people who are barely subsisting to begin with. And so there's the power dynamic, there's the lack of trust between older Black folks and the state, given their experience of what the state has done and sanctioned in their lives. And so all of that is sort of happening as the Federal Writers Project is being conducted. And then after it's out, I think the folks of bad faith didn't want to use them because they said that, you know, there's a school of thought from historians in the sort of a historian named Ulrich B. Phillips, who is sort of famous for writing in the early 20th century that slavery was a largely benevolent institution, mm-hmm. a civilizing institution, that the relationship between enslavers and the enslaved was largely good. And people who are talking about the horrors of slavery, those stories are overblown. And that was, people might not remember, but that is the predominant narrative that existed around what slavery was in the early 20th century. And it wasn't until the Civil Rights Movement in which academics and historians were pushed by activists and inspired by activists and civil rights workers to think differently and to approach the archive differently and to sort of bring back these stories of firsthand testimony from the enslaved. Because previously, the primary source documents that were being used were the diaries of plantation owners and the letters sent from our founding fathers. And and the point that historians started making during the Civil Rights Movement is that, you know, Ulrich B. Phillips and those folks said, well, we can't use the Federal Writers Project work because, you know, they aren't objective. They were too close to the subject of slavery. Their proximity was too too much to be objective. I mean, and you know, one has to interrogate even the notion of like what it means to be objective or mm-hmm. not objective around the issue of slavery. So they began saying that, you know, we know that there are problems with these primary sources, but there are problems with every primary source document, right? Like you can't just read a diary of a man who worked on a plantation or who owned a plantation and take that at face value. You have to consider the biases that exist in that document. And those are the documents we've been using for decades now. So why can't we, use these documents from formerly enslaved folks, knowing that there are limits to the ways in which they can be used and that they have to be used in conversation with other documents. But that's part of what it means to be a historian. Part of it is that you recognize that people bring different biases to every document, and that those biases are carrying, or those documents are carrying the biases of the people who whose stories they're telling. And that's just part of the nature of the work. And so they began in the sort of late 20th century, began becoming more mainstreamed. And now, especially in the sort of Black Lives Matter movement, I think in the same way that historians were inspired by the work that was going on during the civil rights movement, a lot of historians have been revisiting these stories to say, again, to my previous point, like we shouldn't simply rely on the narratives of a few autobiographies of enslaved people who escaped freedom to understand what slavery was. We have this remarkable treasure trove of thousands of first-person accounts, and we should take those seriously.
That was Clint Smith, a staff writer for The Atlantic. Up next, more of another conversation I had about The Atlantic's 2021 Inheritance Project. I'll talk with Adam Harris about an 1870 riot in Utah, Alabama. That's next on Created Equal. Our next guest is Adam Harris. He's staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the book, The State Must Provide. His piece in The Inheritance Project was about a historic race riot in Utah, Alabama, and why it's so important to ensure that truth is reflected in the history books. So you start this piece in a really personal way through letting the reader into your childhood view of your grandfather, who grew up in Alabama in the Jim Crow era. Tell us about him and why his personal story seemed like the right launching point for the deep dive into the history and policy that you explore in this piece.
Yeah, so my granddad was born in 1931 in Sumter County, Alabama, which is, you know, right, it's the county right next to the county which I'm writing about in this story. And as I was kind of poking around and thinking about, the things that shaped Alabama's political legacy, the things that shaped America's political legacy, you know, I was in the EJI files, the Equal Justice Initiative, and I found that, you know, less than a year before my granddad was born, over the 4th of July weekend, three Black people were lynched in Sumter County. And I just thought about, you know, the legacy of violence, the legacy of terror, and how that is directly applicable to America's political landscape. And I thought, you know, this is a man who I watched growing up, who was in love with the news, right? Who was in love with politics, but who always kind of knew the way that things happen, the way that things work. And conversations with him and conversations with his immediate family, you know, that older generation, they always kind of had this idea of the way that politics worked and why things were the way they were, as I write in the piece. And so that was kind of the launching point to say, you know, I can tell the story of the tenuous nature of American progress through, my grandfather, through this man who grew up in it, who grew up in the silty clay of Sumter County, and who knows the stories and the roots of that legacy that's buried there.
Yeah, I feel like for us as African Americans, that's always a powerful echo. The things we hear from our relatives, close relatives, who experienced these things firsthand. And it's one of those things that reminds us of how close it all is to the modern day. My father was born in 1933 in Mississippi and is not allowed to vote in his home state until he's in his mid-30s because of Jim Crow. I feel like any African-American you ask about this kind of experience and sort of how those inequalities are framed in your mind, it always starts with a personal story from somebody that we knew. It's not somebody we read about in a book a long time ago. I mean, your grandfather, my father, yeah. These are men who raised us.
Exactly. It is, you know, it just goes to, as you were mentioning, you know, it goes to the point of how recent all of this was. You know, my mom was born in 1963 in Andalusia, Alabama. And, you know, just miles down the road, you know, that's where, you know, four little girls are murdered mm-hmm. in a church in Birmingham. So this is all very, very recent.
Yeah. So like many southern states, you point out that Alabama hid aspects of its history for years, omitting them from textbooks and disregarding them in classrooms, which meant Black people learned their history from one another. And that really reinforces the deeper cultural importance of these relationships with our elders, but it also really highlights the gaps that exist in other people's understanding or knowledge of these things. And I think that helps explain some of the tensions that we have now. For us, this is gospel. This is what we grew up reading and hearing and listening about. For other people, it seems much more distant.
Yeah, I think, and that's in part due to this, you know, the reason why history textbooks and things are shaped the way that they are is to kind of reinforce this idea of it's sort of like the myth of consistent American progress, when in reality, the American project has been, you know, we sort of wasted these critical junctures when things could be better. You have Reconstruction where you know, it's this moment of radical political reimagination. And then immediately after, you start having these riots like the one in Utah, like the ones that would follow in Eufaula and Mobile, that literally usurp democracy, that overturn elections and ensure the status quo and this sort of regime, this reign of terror, kind of ensured by this legacy that we explicitly omit to grapple or to sort of hold on to this myth of continual progress.
Yeah. So I want to go back to your grandfather for a second. You spend a lot of time in the piece talking about how the things that he experienced in Alabama as a young man shaped his outlook on the world, but I want to go back to this very specific thing that happened, this massacre, this lynching, and what effect that in particular you think had on your grandfather and the way that he saw not only his place in this country but the country more generally. What did that elicit from him?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, you know, my granddad was born in 1931, and the political atmosphere that he was born into was shaped by this riot, right? By this act of political terror that occurred in the 1870s. So 50 years before, 60 years before he's born, right? There's a riot that completely sort of reshapes politics in Alabama, where you know, Republicans, more liberal, progressive, kind of the radical Republicans, were in power in the governor's mansion, in the state house, the congressional delegation were led by Republicans at the time. And, you know, on October 25th, 1870, at the courthouse in Utah, Alabama, there's a Democratic rally and a Republican rally. The Democratic rally ends a little bit early, and they move over to the Republican rally, and the Republican rally has consisted of about 2,000 or so Black men, you know, a handful of white men, But, you know, there's this point where the Democrats had been sort of drinking and becoming increasingly hostile. One of the speakers is yanked from the stage, and then a shot is fired from one of the Democrats into the Black crowd. And then several more shots, right? It's a flurry of gunshots. Four people die, more than 50 people are injured, all Black. At you know, a congressional hearing to investigate the Ku Klux Klan, to investigate the kind of the political usurping of Alabama, you know, one of the senators who was there, who was speaking, said, you know, they emptied their guns into the backs of those people. And that effectively, by doing that, it was days before election day. It scared people away from the polls. You know, numbers where, you know, you'd have a Republican who's winning by 2,000 votes, they were all of a sudden, you know, losing by 35 votes. You know, this was historians sort of call it a coup. They say that this election was stolen. And after stealing that election, they learned that, you know, through the fact that there were no consequences, there was sort of impunity in this, that sort of political status quo just continued. And the reign of terror continued into the birth of my grandfather in the sharecropping South of 1931. And so, you know, his parents, his grandparents grew up with that. They grew up in that. And so he lived, you know, as you mentioned, you know, 30 some odd years on, it was 30 some odd years on before he, you know, could enjoy the full rights of citizenship in America, and, you know, be able to vote with the Voting Rights Act, a strong Voting Rights Act where states needed preclearance. And so I guess to get back to your point, I think the way that shapes his worldview is just that, you know, he hears these stories from his parents, I hear these stories from my parents, from him, and it sort of lets you know everything you need to know, right? There's a moment of progress, and America does not respond well to Black progress. Yeah. And time after time, when you see Black progress, it is followed by violence. It is followed by these intentional suppression efforts to sort of reestablish the status quo. Mm.
I'm talking with Adam Harris, a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the forthcoming book, The State Must Provide. We're talking about his piece in the series of pieces that The Atlantic is doing as part of a project called Inheritance, which is an effort to explore the legacy and experiences of Black Americans that have been largely left out of our history books. We're talking about how the absence of understanding of this history frames people's understanding today, but also framed the ongoing discrimination that African Americans have faced in our country, the lack of knowledge that fuels inequality in America. Adam, there is kind of a response to what happens in 1870 that you deal with in the piece, and it's not a response that's particularly helpful. Talk about how that kind of inculcates the idea that that what happened to the Black men who were killed in 1870 was okay, and that things were not going to change.
Yeah, so after the riot, there is this there's a court case. So a white clerk goes to Demopolis to file a complaint against Jonathan J. Jolly, against, you know, a handful of Democrats who took part in this massacre. And the federal government ends up framing the charges under the Enforcement Act to say that, you know, the federal government has a responsibility to protect Black people from explicit acts of violence by private actors when the state will not step in and fill that role. Mm. The judge in the case ultimately agrees. He says that, you know, the 14th Amendment grants equal protection. You know, it's equivalent to the Privileges and Immunities Clause. So you are granted all of the protections that are enumerated in the Constitution, which at the moment, right, this is, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, you know, what Eric Foner calls the Second Founding, we were still trying to understand what these amendments could do, the extent to which these amendments protected Black Americans. So the fact that in this case, the judge kind of has this radical idea about how the extent of that protection, that protection extends to Black people as far back as the Constitution, that that is sort of stymied almost immediately, right? Even though the judge has this broad interpretation, ultimately no one is charged. There are no consequences. So it's sort of this impunity for all of this. Immediately after he's acquitted, Jolly, who I mentioned a moment ago, actually runs for office, you know, in the county. And so essentially it just established that lawless violence that these efforts to limit progress would not go punished. And with that in mind, with the backing of subsequent court cases, the Cruikshank case, the Slaughterhouse cases on, you know, through Plessy versus Ferguson, you just have these cases that reinforce this idea that Black citizenship is not on par with white citizenship, that the federal government is not going to protect Black citizens as vigorously, which allows these paramilitary groups like the Klan to sort of have free reign in the South and elsewhere.
Okay, Adam Harris, staff writer at The Atlantic. It was really great to have you here with us for this conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
So really interesting series that The Atlantic did called Inheritance, and really interesting work that each of these pieces kind of took on to try to fill in gaps in Black history. The interview with Clint Smith in particular just kind of pops out to me in terms of the power of what they were trying to do and what kind of emotional imprint it would make on you if you were doing that. Imagine going through and reading 2,300 narratives of people who were enslaved in this country and reading about their lives, reading about the things that happened to them, and frankly, reading about what mattered to them at the time, you know, the things that they thought were important enough to keep a record of in some way, you know, and in the conversation with Clint, I bring that up, how most of us don't get that opportunity in history, right, to hear or to see directly what somebody experienced. But he did that with 2,300 people who had been enslaved.
There's something a little resonant about being able to see or hear. I don't know if they wrote this specifically, but like imagine seeing like a day-to-day schedule of like, I got up this morning and like I tended to just your chores for the day, right? What's on your schedule? What does your day look like? It's very different from ours. Communication is very different at that time. How you spend your time is very different, you know, especially being in those circumstances. So I couldn't imagine what it would be like.
And the specter of this enslavement, which of course dominates people's lives, but also I think in some ways disappears into the woodwork. It's just your life. It's just the way things are.
Right.
And you don't, for many of them, you have no idea what would be different or how it might be different. You're just trying to survive. And the idea of keeping a record of those things in that way and reflecting that is just remarkable. It's just, it's incredible. It's incredible that it was preserved that way, but it's even more incredible, I'm sure, to go tell that story now because it hasn't been told before.
Yeah, I think I always try to find little relics that remind me of my older relatives or are part of my lineage. Because it's just nice to know or be familiar with what it was like for them or the things that they enjoyed. So that's really a touching and resonating episode.
It was a great series in The Atlantic. It's called Inheritance. You can go to their website and still read it, I'm quite sure. But we had great conversations here on WDET back when we were doing a show called Detroit Today about all of those pieces. That's it for this episode of Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Our digital production team is Jenny Sherman, Dave Kim, and Sophia Joswiak. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.